It's 12:11 a.m. in Tornillo, Texas, and you're listening to Night Call. Hello and welcome to Night Call, a call-in show for our dystopian reality. My name is Emily Yoshida. I'm in Los Angeles, and with me on the other line are
Molly Lambert and
Tess Leach.
And later on in the show, we're going to be joined by our special guest, Sadie Dupuis, aka Sad 13. She's here to talk about her new album, Haunted Painting, also just ghosts in general, haunted studios, a bunch of fun stuff, so stay tuned for that. But right now, we're bringing back our new segment, Pyramid Pals. We introduced it last week, and it's definitely going to be with us every single week from now on. You can depend on a Pyramid Pals segment every week, just like Kratom Corner. But we got a bunch of calls after we talked about the Ames Monument and the Luxor last week. So let's take a pyramid call.
Let's take that pyramid call.
Hi, Night Call. I'm a first-time caller from Minneapolis. I'm an architectural historian, and just heard you talking about the Ames Pyramid, designed by Henry Hobson Richardson. Just want to call in a little bit more information about Richardson, because he's very important and very weird. He has a style, an architectural style named after him, which is called Richardsonian Romanesque. It's growing off of the Romanesque style, but with his own personal twist on it. And it's very medieval looking. It's very heavy. It's known for having rusticated stonework, which is like what you see at the Ames Monument. And Richardson is considered part of the Holy Trinity of American architecture. If you're into that kind of deifying architects as geniuses, he's right up there with Louis Sullivan and Frank Lloyd Wright, both of whom were influenced by his work. Richardson was also kind of a weirdo. He, later on in his life, when he retired to Massachusetts to work from home in his home studio, he would apparently, whenever clients would go to visit him, he would ring a gong, or rather have his assistants ring a gong, and then he would walk out to greet the clients wearing a monk outfit, like full robes. He's not a monk, but he wanted to reinforce the sort of medievalness of his design. And so some of his most famous works are the Trinity Church in Boston, Massachusetts, and the New York State Asylum in Buffalo, New York. They're both really good examples of his work, but it's very influential. And like the Minneapolis downtown has several Richardsonian Romanesque buildings. So be sure to give him a Google and see his monk outfit, because it's very convincing. The pyramid sounds cool. Can't wait to visit. Thanks.
I actually love Richardsonian Romanesque architecture. There's like a lot of it, I feel like, in Brooklyn, or like, you know, if it's not designed by him, it's at least kind of influenced by him. It's that kind, like any kind of brick building that has a turret in it.
Yeah.
Like it's like the kind of Victorian cake house type thing, except all like red brick. Looks fantastic. I think like the Tenenbaum's house and Royal Tenenbaum's, I feel like, is sort of in this vein.
Oh, totally.
That kind of thing.
I like the, they say that they have the cylindrical towers with the conical caps. The conical caps.
Yeah. Conical caps. Cones. Little witch hats on top of your buildings. Yes, please. More of that. I did not know he was such a weirdo, though. Why are so many architects weirdos?
They're like directors, because mm-hmm. they have crazy visions in their head that mostly don't ever get made, and yeah. they're obsessive control freaks and artists. Architects are actually the most interesting people to me. I know a lot of them for some reason. I have a bunch of friends that are architects, because you have to be a math person, an engineering person, and a creative person.
Yeah.
That's the part that I never could, you know, I'm like, I could draw a building, but could I make it stand up? No.
Right. Yeah. Think about load bearing and whatnot. No.
Also very high stakes.
Extremely high stakes.
In terms of art, it's like, that's art that can kill people.
All art can kill people.
Okay, that's true. That's fair. This could kill a lot of people all at once, though, by accident.
But yeah, I mean, the Holy Trinity that this caller is talking about are amazing.
Stone cold weirdos.
All total weirdos, stone cold weirdos. But also, yeah, they're remarkable for having all built so much stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for so much of it being standing.
Yeah. And built a lot of stuff and then had so much stuff that's sort of aping the style. I feel like we get a lot, you know, it's funny because like, yeah, he seems like most of his work is on the East Coast, but then also a ton in the upper Midwest. That's sort of similar with Frank Lloyd Wright. Like very, like, I don't know, the Midwest seems like a like upper Midwest, Illinois, Wisconsin, et cetera, feels like a good architecture zone. But yeah, we also got another pyramid email. This one was from Corey, who wrote to us about a different pyramid, a much more recent pyramid. They write, "Hi, Night Call. It's my unfortunate duty to inform you about a recent American pyramid demolition. The AstraZeneca pyramid in Westboro, Massachusetts was torn down this January. It was built in the late 2000s and was always an important landmark to my friends and I when we were teenagers delivering pizzas and generally cruising around the suburbs late at night. It was a tall, four-sided pyramid made of blue mirrored glass that had a distinctly evil presence, which made sense seeing as it served as the American headquarters for a big pharma giant. The building was raised to make way for a new 40 million Amazon robotics lab, which doesn't even make sense because wouldn't you just keep the evil pyramid if you were building an Amazon robotics lab? I'm attaching some pictures to give you an idea of how truly bizarre this office building pyramid in the middle of the New England suburbs was." And they also sent a video, but this is wild. Did you guys know about this?
I had never heard of this. No.
In
Westboro? It looks like the Louvre pyramid. I can't really get a sense of how big it is from these photos in this article, which is in the Metro West Daily News. I had to like answer a survey to read this article because that's the state of local news, I guess, right now. But yeah, they're like, you know, you can see them in the photos, like ripping it to shreds.
Yeah, the picture of the pyramid being shredded is pretty crazy.
It's also weird to me that it looks like it's built of either, it's like mirrored glass is what it looks like. I just can't imagine how blinding that thing must have been with the sun bouncing off of it. But what a strange thing to have in the middle of Massachusetts. And also it is very, what an odd decision to tear down this strange evil build. I mean, it looks exactly on brand for Amazon. It's like, you know.
Well, I think maybe on brand, you know, in terms of reality and what Amazon actually represents. But, you know, Amazon is like really trying to rehab their image right now in a very stupid way. Like they're running all these ads about how they're trying to like green their business or whatever, and how like Amazon is actually the most virtuous company on earth or whatever. And like everybody there cares about their children's future. I'm sure that many people at Amazon care about their children's future, but come on. I think like, this makes sense to us as like, yes, Amazon should live in the evil pyramid.
It's what they deserve.
But Amazon's like, no, we should live in a Higa little cottage. Like we should be the cutie Silicon Valley giant.
Pyramids aren't evil though. They're just...
But this one looks evil.
This one does look evil. That's also because it's partially gutted. So its guts are spilling out. And it actually, the way that it... You know, in this one picture, it looks like shredded paper is kind of coming out of it because of the supports and like joists and stuff. And it looks like it's kind of being torn to ribbons. But it also, I mean, it's weird because in LA, you get so used to having such a mix of architecture and there are just really no rules kind of seem to apply unless you're in a historic preservation overlay. But Massachusetts, it's rare to see a mirrored pyramid in the middle of the place. So should it kept the pyramid?
People must have been pissed about the mirrored pyramid, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah. When that first went up.
Well, it's also so new. It was built in the 2000s. Like, you built a pyramid and it has a lifespan of like 50. That's got to be the shortest lifespan of any pyramid ever constructed.
the not least made ancient of, like, sand. Pyramid.
Yeah, the least ancient pyramid because it's like post Luxor, but got raised before Luxor.
We love getting calls and emails about pyramids and architectural styles. Super interesting.
Yeah, keep them coming. More mids.
On the subject of aesthetics, I wanted to talk about 2020 October's Sweetie. the 12-foot skeleton from Home Depot.
Go on.
Have you guys seen them? Have you seen it?
Yeah. No, I even went to Home Depot recently. I don't know what...
They're sold out, Emily.
They're sold out everywhere.
You have to look at the pictures.
My friend went to get one, yeah. And they were all gone, and they were already putting out Christmas stuff.
So this also was written about in Mel Magazine. Miles Klee wrote a piece called "There's Something About Home Depot's 12-Foot Skeleton," and there certainly is. They have animated eyes that kind of glow. 12 feet is quite tall. When you really think about it,
it's a strange height to pick.
It's not a super strange height.
Yeah. It's like I recently had this weird double take moment where I saw it in my rear view mirror, or maybe it was like on a truck that there was like a photo on the truck, like it was a Ralph's truck or whatever that had a lady on it, like, you know, smiling, you know, like, I don't know, a Ralph's employee or whatever. But it was just big enough that I was like, that's a huge woman over there. And then I realized that it was just a painting. But like when you're in that weird uncanny zone between where it's like truly just a giant thing, like a big blow up inflatable skeleton or something.
Also, we're also like unfamiliar with the world again now that everything feels a little bit like that. I had an experience a couple days ago where I thought a squirrel running towards me was a cat. And then when it got close, I was like, it's a very small cat. Oh, no, it's a squirrel. but just like, I feel like, yeah, my sense of size is all out of whack. And so the 12-foot skeleton, it just feels to me completely right for our moment culturally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What is it? What is it about this that speaks to our moment?
Here's what I think. As a connoisseur of Halloween decorations, I just like when people like put dumb shit on their lawns. It's really that for me. I like that people decorate their houses in a way that is tacky, you know?
I love maximalist Halloween houses.
Yeah, oh, yeah, exactly. And I love what people do with like not that much stuff, you know? I'm not that into the like expensive haunts or the like fancy, you know, things like that, that people, you know, theme park haunts are fine. But what I like is like a janky yard display. So there's been a lot of things in the yard display arena. There's been just like more and more innovations. There was this period where they were just like pumping out more and more Halloween things. There were like the inflatable giant black cats all of a sudden. And then those things that let you project on the house. There's just like an arms race for Halloween stuff. And there was more and more of it, and then it hit this like cliff in the past couple years because everything's fucking depressing and scary, and maybe people don't want to and people maybe have less money also to spend on Halloween garbage. So I felt like last year there was no Halloween decorating. Did you guys feel that way?
I was like so not tuned into Halloween last year, and now I feel like I missed out. Like it was
there
the last
was a huge brouhaha in my neighborhood about Halloween and trick-or-treating where neighbors were fighting over what was perceived to be a lack of commitment to decorating houses during Halloween and also a lack of commitment to children staying in their own neighborhoods to trick-or-treat.
Who cares?
It was a really brutal, gossipy, strange conversation.
That's so weird.
I just sat it out and read all those emails and was like, that's super crazy.
I would be so stressed out
at you. That's, that's like a Shirley Jackson story.
It absolutely is. I'm always reporting from the weirdest neighborhood in the world to you guys, apparently. It's very plugged in.
It was like for years, every year there would be some new innovation in Halloween decorating that I had never seen before. And then it stopped. It was like, we've reached the limit. There's nothing new. We have all these inflatables and projections and things. Like this is as far as it goes. And there was nothing new last year. And then this year, the big boy appeared.
The big boy.
The big boy.
The big boy. And he has like light up scary eyes. It's just the most ominous thing I've ever seen.
It's really scary.
It's really scary, but it's so scary it becomes funny because it's like totally unsettling.
Yeah.
And it just feels like we turned this corner into just plunging into the absurdity of now.
There is something about it formally, like, it's not an inflatable. It's not a thing that's like been painted onto something. It is literally a skeleton, a solid skeleton.
And it's a fucking skeleton in a time when we're having a plague. It feels like medieval to me, you know?
In a time of like refrigerated body trucks, like we are going to put giant skeletons out on our lawns just because let's go all the way. I don't know.
It's funny because it's so incredibly impractical. And I think that with Halloween decorations, when Molly was talking about the lack of innovation, I think it's also just kind of, I mean, at least in my neighborhood, you can feel when people are getting tired of putting in the effort. Like you can only do it so many years in a row. If you're doing it for like neighborhood kids or for your own kids, eventually those kids are too old and you're not going to care. But you have to like stow all of that stuff for most of the year. Yeah. 364 days.
Who
almost.
Says though? No rules. Like we're living in crazy
How
times.
Do you could keep that out. A 12-foot
You don't.
Skeleton.
You keep it out.
I'm hoping that some of them stay up through Christmas and they just put Santa hats on them.
Can you pose them? Like
no, you can't. I watched a video because I was very like, how do you get them to stand up? What are they mounted on? I wanted to know, so I watched an unboxing video made by these like two kids, like a couple of dudes that are like 10, you know, who are like, nice. Get the box. They're so excited. And then they unbox it and like show you how they build it.
You have to build it?
Yeah, you have to build it. It's 12 feet tall. It doesn't just stand up by itself because it's fucking 12 feet tall.
Are they all the bones and you put them together?
Yes. And it's so crazy. Wow. It's like there's like a base and you mount it to the base and then you put the feet on and you build it upwards. And these kids, I think, had to stand on something to get to the top.
This reminds me of this woodblock, like one of my favorite Japanese woodblocks ever, of the giant skeleton.
Exactly.
That's like breaking down the walls and terrifying.
And there's something about a giant thing. I've just also been watching all these theme park videos, and I watched a bunch about Kongfrontation, which was a King Kong ride at Universal that had a giant King Kong animatronic, and it looks just very terrifying and amazing to me because it's like the scale of it is so big.
Yeah.
You know, there's something about just like taking the scale of something and making it big. And again, the skeletons are like, it felt like for a few years, people didn't want to be reminded of how bad things were, of death, and kind of felt like Halloween, you know, amped down a little bit after maybe hitting this peak of just all the haunt stuff in LA, especially too. And now it feels like it's good. It's like, yeah, we shouldn't be able to not think about death right now.
To play devil's advocate, we can't not think about death. There have been a lot of conflicting opinions on social media about whether like Americans are having to confront the fact that they don't think about death enough and now we're going to have to think about death more versus like just acknowledge. I feel like I think about death constantly. I'm never not thinking about death. But I don't know. I mean, just to play devil's advocate, a giant 12-foot skeleton when you're having to talk to your kids and mask them up and being like, don't worry, everything's fine. There's just a disease that kills people. And then being like, happy Halloween. Here's some giant terrifying skeletons. Like, that might be a fun talk to have with my kids.
I think, you know, in general, I should say there's probably all sorts of different reactions to this. But I think if things manage to turn around and this isn't the last like 15 years of human civilization or whatever, I think that the kids who are kids right now are going to be better equipped to think about death and life and death basically than we were. And I think probably most generations in like modern, you know, modern civilization.
I'm going to play Angel's advocate over here.
No, I'm being Angel's advocate. That's a nice thought.
Oh, okay. I'm going to play, you know, chaotic angel, devil, which advocate, which is what I always play in this podcast. I do think that like each generation of children has its own thing like that. Like we grew up around the AIDS crisis.
Yeah.
And so I was definitely I felt like that kind of gives you this like dose of realism when you're a kid, you know, because they had.
How immediate was that for you as a kid? I guess you guys were a little bit older for me.
I grew up in the West Village.
Right.
So that was like constant. Yeah. And also my parents worked in entertainment. So many of their friends were, you know, infected with HIV and had partners die of AIDS. Like when I remember being around 8 years old or 9 years old and just having it be like a constant thought for me.
Yeah.
But I think this is different because children during the AIDS epidemic, most of them did not have to like take too many precautions to like adapt their own lives.
There was a lot of television. I'm specifically thinking of, there was like a Sesame Street segment. There were a lot of segments about, there was a kid named Ryan White who was the first kid born infected with HIV. And he was on television a lot just, you know, to be educating people about the fact that like HIV can be passed and that also it's okay to like hang out with people who have HIV. That was a big part of it. Was like,
I remember this campaign. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there was a big thing where he, like Alyssa Milano kissed him on, I think, the Phil Donahue show or something to like prove that like you can kiss somebody who has HIV and you can hold hands with them and you're not, you know,
at risk of transmission. But
yeah,
I mean, think about the difference between us experiencing the HIV and AIDS epidemic as children and how children now are interpreting in particular the world outside their homes as being
I just feel like vectors. They don't know anything else.
Oh, right. They do. I mean, it depends on your kid's age. I don't know. I definitely hope that at least some good comes out of this in terms of being able to recognize how people look after each other. I mean, I think maybe one of the only good things about being a kid and having to talk with your parents about why people are wearing masks, which to younger kids can look super scary, and to be able to have a conversation about how that's taking care of each other and like kind of thinking beyond the visual of like you see someone, you don't recognize them, you can't see if they're smiling, and to just be able to be like, oh, that's in order to protect other people, that's like, you know, a community effort, has been really great and productive. But I often worry because I have OCD and I can be a little obsessive about germophobic things. And as a kid, that was definitely true as well. So I don't know. It could be an interesting Halloween if your kid is already a little freaked out. However, I'm still pro 12-foot skeleton.
Well, that just starts a whole new conversation, you know?
I feel like the 12-foot skeletons just provide an opportunity to release some of the fear and stress and anxiety that's in the air for obvious reasons. It just feels, it feels right for the year.
Well, it's how like the best horror movies, I think, make you laugh more than they make you like scream or be genuinely scared. And I think there's something about the giggles that you get when you see these 12-foot skeletons that is very cathartic and very healthy.
It's cathartic, and it's not like, there are other things that are way scarier to me than that. The thing I find the scariest is when somebody puts like a figurine in their window, like a human looking person, and it's not human, you know, like a mannequin.
Like in Home Alone.
I find mannequins scarier than the 12-foot skeleton, personally.
I got a fuzzy styrofoam cat, a black cat, that you're supposed to mount on a wall, and we've had it for many years, and at one point its styrofoam leg broke off, and now it's a three-legged Halloween cat. And for some reason that made me, that I was like, now it's terrifying. So anything can be terrifying.
It's okay. it's just a handicapped cat. It's cool.
It's because the leg's out at an angle. It just,
but people,
you know,
love those three-legged dogs. They're like, oh, look, he's so cute and brave.
That could be.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be joined by our guest this week, Sadie Dupuis. Welcome back to Night Call. We are now joined by Sadie Dupuis, aka Sad 13, which I just learned you actually say Sad 13. She's also the front woman of Speedy Ortiz, and she's got a new album out called Haunted Painting, which obviously is right up our freaking alley. Hi, Sadie.
Hi, Emily. Welcome to the show. Very nice to see you again from a Zoom distance.
Yeah, everybody, I just get like reminded what everybody looks like when they're kind of like in work mode and at home over Zoom, which is like when we shot the video a couple of years ago.
You've only seen me in like costume and makeup.
Well, it's like that or ultimate, just like rolling into a studio at 6 a.m, like, you know, haven't had your coffee yet type of thing. So it's the two extremes. But
I'm somewhere right in the middle today.
I'm definitely on the rolled out of bed side today, but nobody can see, which is great. So you have a new album out. It's been out a couple weeks now.
Yes, 2 weeks today.
2 weeks. It's 2 weeks old. Happy birthday.
Thank you. Feels like a year. Why is time so messed up right now?
I know. It's so crazy. I was going back and listening to it again, and I was listening to WTD, which I remember you put out. I couldn't tell you when you put that out, but I was like, that's on this album, I guess.
May feels May.
What the hell? Yeah. I mean, I love that song. And I was just like, oh, yeah, this is great. I remember hearing this, you know, 2 years ago. It must have been 2 years ago. It's sort of wild how that works. It's definitely got to be weird, I think, like releasing stuff or like building up anticipation for something like an album when time is meaningless.
It's weird. And it's also so much more internet time than I'm used to. I think every time I've put out a record before, I'm either already on tour or I leave the next day. And I'm not just looking at the computer all day long, giving myself back pain from hunching over, staring into a screen. So time's moving very fast, very slow. I think this is a universal quarantine experience.
Did you have a tour set up for this album that you had to postpone?
I had touring through, like, starting in March through pretty much the end of the year. So who knows when that will happen again. 2022 is kind of the general feeling. But
what weird habits have you developed instead in quarantine?
Oh, no.
We're going right into the dark stuff.
Well, I had a funny experience at the grocery store the other day. Have you ever had... Who's from New York besides Emily, or at least has lived there?
I've spent a few years, like as a kid, was there.
Oh, okay.
Tess is from New York, but she doesn't claim it.
I don't like to claim it.
Tess, I'm from New York too, so.
Yeah, okay.
And I don't live there anymore.
Wait, but you also spent time in Connecticut, right?
Mm-hmm. I went to high school there.
All right. I went to junior high there.
Oh, where did you? Where? Yeah.
Sharon.
Oh, weird. So you know about Dudleytown too, probably.
Oh, I do.
Oh my God. Okay. So we'll have to go there.
I hope we're heading towards Stu Leonard's again. That's just my...
Oh, I was just talking about Stu Leonard's because a friend just moved to... Tess, you maybe know where Southbury, Connecticut is.
You know I know where Southbury is.
Not really a hot spot.
Oh my God.
Nope. But I went to see her at like a far away outdoor distance, and I was like, you're going to go to Stu Leonard's now that you're living up here?
When this podcast goes deep New England, it's like hieroglyphics in front of my eyes.
Yeah.
I'm like, what's that?
Stu Leonard's is a huge grocery store with so many animatronics.
We've already kind of made Emily sit through a Stu Leonard's explainer, but you can't really explain Stu Leonard's.
Animatronics and songs. Yeah. When first got Instagram, I only posted animatronic videos for like the first 2 years I had it. And I'm certain that Stu Leonard's made an appearance there.
Oh, it should.
My weird habit, though, is I am just eating like a jar of Rick's Picks spicy pickled green beans like every single day. And it is nauseating my partner, who hates the smell of them. But I go to the grocery store. They're like $10 a
jar. They're fancy.
And I go to the grocery store and I buy like six at a time. And the cashier's like, are these good? And I responded, I don't know, but they're my hobby. it felt like a bleak moment for my mental health. But
how is your stomach lining? Like, I would think all that ass. That's the only downside. That's what keeps me from eating all pickles all day.
I'm sure it's horrible, but I think I have IBS all the time, so I just don't notice the difference.
Just throw fuel on the fire. Yeah, throw pickles on the fire.
It's already going to feel bad. Let's just make it all go faster. Good hobby, right?
That's a great hobby. I mean, it's all about like, we talked about this on a bonus podcast where we had an entire episode about beverages. Like, I feel like you can get completely invested just in like, ooh, ooh, what's a new beverage I'm into now? Yeah. Like, what's a new thing I never thought of getting before at the store? And now this is like the height of entertainment.
What's everyone's new beverage?
Oh, man. I've been drinking this very expensive juice. So I like split it into thirds and mix it with seltzer. That's, I forget what the brand is, but it's Sweet Citrus. And it's like, it's pretending to be fresh squeezed, but I think it's cold pressed. But at some point I was having terrible allergies and I became convinced that this was like the cure. But now it's awful because like I'm like basically microdosing this juice because it's like $6 for a small bottle. So I'm making like shrubs with it. I'm trying to like stretch the juice.
It's that good, sounds though. Nice.
That's like that's like the good end of novelty beverages because you're also like making something out of it.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm cooking. Yeah,
it's an activity and a thing that you're eating. Yes. It's the best of all hobbies.
Sadie, I noticed that in your merch store you have hot sauce and hazelnut spread.
Speaking of food, we did a tea as well.
Really? What kind of tea?
It's called a haunted breakfast. I'm putting scare quotes in the air. it's a lapsang souchong and a couple other like black teas that one of smoky. Which was harvested under a blood moon. There's this really great tea maker in Philly called Craft Tea, and he supplies to all the local music venues and a couple different cafes. And he started making teas to do as like pairings with records. I reached out to him and we put this together, and he was like dropping off samples at my front door like once a week for a couple months just tweaking the formula. So I can say it's been thoroughly taste tested. It's really good. And ooh. I think it's sold out, so I don't know why I'm going in on it right now, but I have some personal tins, maybe if you know.
For the right price.
VIP tea tins. That sounds great. I mean, I love edible tour merch or band merch. That's just
I know.
Like,
I guess it doesn't really serve the purpose of like advertising my band in the way that like a t-shirt or like a wearable merch does.
No, it totally does.
I feel like people are more likely to share that on Instagram though. It's like, look, I have hazelnut spread for my favorite musician, ? Cool.
Yeah. It makes perfect sense. It's like you can't go to the show, so you sit at home and listen to the album and brew your cup of haunted tea.
And eat a whole thing of Nutella.
Yeah. It's a lifestyle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've wanted to do food merch in the past, but it's just not tenable when you're in a van for like 3 months going through all kinds of different climates. So as soon as like touring was canceled for the foreseeable future, I was like, it's finally my time to do food stuff.
That's amazing. Was the hot sauce also a similar, like, was it like a custom thing that you brewed?
Yeah, it's they're, speaking of Connecticut, I think they're from Willimantic. Dragon's Blood Elixir. And we had talked like 5 years ago about doing a hot sauce together, but it was a similar deal that trying to carry glass on tour is like a nightmare.
Yeah.
So it like literally the first piece of merch that I planned out as soon as the quarantine happened.
Can we talk about haunted paintings a little bit?
Yeah.
Yes.
What do you got?
What haunted paintings were you thinking of when you were making this album? Was there anything in particular or just the idea?
It was more the idea of a haunted painting. And in fact, I think I looked up, once I had the idea for the title, I did a bunch of Googling, and I don't really like any of the like haunted painting meme stories that are going around. I don't know if you've investigated any of these.
Is this like a genre? I didn't know.
There's like two that have sold on eBay for like very high prices because they're theoretically haunted. And there was a whole disclaimer of like, we're not liable for you getting murdered if you buy this painting. But they're not as creepy or captivating as the one that I named this after, which is a Franz Stuck portrait of a dancer named Saharit, who we painted a couple times, but this is one on display at the Frey Gallery in Seattle. And probably the whole reason I even thought to frame it as haunted, not only is it surrounded by some of his other work that's like really creepy looking, The Sin, I think, is like one of his really famous ones. That's like a big serpent a round woman.
I'm looking up this one.
Can't really look at that one. I can't look at snakes. But it's a few blocks away from a hotel that I got put up in for a poetry festival in Seattle. And I was staying with Dorothy Alasky, who's a poet that is one of my favorites. And she is also really into ghostly and haunted things and has even like taught workshops on poetry and ghosts. And I think a lot of poets have that particular fixation. But the hotel is supposedly haunted by Alice B. Toklas, which doesn't make sense at all.
What hotel is it? I lived in Seattle for a little bit. I can speak Seattle more than Connecticut.
If I Google it right now, you're going to hear all my typing.
But I love the Fry also. The Fry is like, I don't know, it's like a very cool space. It feels
really,
a
really cool music.
Really like tucked away. You can't, it doesn't feel like you're in the middle of town.
It's the Sorrento Hotel. Do you know that?
Oh, yeah.
It's like apparently the
oldest. I used to live right next to it. So, yeah.
So apparently Alice B. Toklas' ghost did too.
oh, wow. I had no idea about that. That's wild.
So we walked around the hotel all night trying to find like any ghost and had zero luck, even though Dottie was staying on like the apparently very haunted floor. And I went to the museum the next day and was like, this painting's more haunted than this museum. And that's kind of how I came to the title and concept.
I'm looking at this, the Sin painting. It's like, this is a cursed painting. This is like something from like a 70s horror movie. It's so...
If you Google Franz von Stuck, his work is just... Even the Saharat portrait's not theoretically supposed to be creepy, but it just is.
Aren't all paintings haunted if they're painted by a dead person?
Interesting theory.
Or is painted it like a by a dead person.
Oh, I just mean, aren't all? Isn't every painting in a museum haunted in a way?
I think past. That some, like, I think that in the poetic sense, a portrait, like, if you've ever seen a portrait that, you know, like, I think a lot of like John Singer Sargent portraits feel like very animated and like kind of charged to me because I just think he was great at it. And I think there is like a weird sense of time travel when you're in a gallery with those portraits and you are really confronting the fact that, ah, these people were all living once. And like, because this artist was particularly good at capturing like a light in their eyes or something like that, it really feels like they're right there with you. And that can be a bit of an uncanny feel. I mean, that feels more or less functionally like it's haunted. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know the rules though for hauntings.
I'll accept this. All portraits are haunted for this reason.
It's a very natural human urge, right? To like, you know, capture somebody in time or whatever. But it's also like, it feels almost like you're bending the laws of time. Now I'm getting into the all jokes are time travel type.
See?
All paintings are haunted. All jokes are time travel.
I've caught the bug.
It's real.
Yeah.
Paintings are time travel.
I think also a lot of portraiture, especially like a lot of it's commissioned by like super wealthy people, right? Who only want to be portrayed in a very flattering way. And the same way with, you know, photography now. So I think to see the Franz von Stuck paintings that in some ways are kind of not flattering, like the portrait that I was really captivated by, Saharat's under eye circles are really exaggerated. Her eyes are just kind of enlarged in a way that it honestly reminds me of like a jump scare face in a way.
Yeah,
it's like somewhere between a beautiful portrait and a jump scare. So I think I'm really interested in paintings that do that. For their portrait.
I have a print that is gigantic that I was given for like, I think it was probably around the time I graduated from college. It's this guy, Alex Colville, who is a Canadian magic realist. And it's a woman staring. She's on a boat and she has binoculars and she's like staring out. But it's such a huge print. And I didn't know where to put it when we moved. So it's in the bedroom. And like, I just, every so often my kids are like, can you cover that or so? Because she's just like staring and then it like faces a mirror. So she's like staring at herself and it's like bouncing back. And at some point one of my kids was like, does that ever give you the creeps that there's like a giant head staring at you with binoculars? And I was like, yeah, it does. Maybe I like that. Like, maybe it's good. But I also feel like the bigger the painting and the bigger the portrait, they can definitely get some kind of like a haunted quality because it's so like dominating and it feels like it kind of just takes over the vibe. Sure.
You just made me realize my bedroom is full of paintings because my boyfriend is a painter. And some of them are a little haunted looking, but I also find them comforting and cozy. It's like you have friends around.
They're staring at you in your
bedroom. He's there to control them if they start acting up, at least.
Right, exactly. He made them. He can put them back in.
It's my test. That just reminded me that my dad had an Elvis bust when I was growing up that was in the hallway, like outside of my bedroom, and I could see it while I was sleeping.
Like,
and
I would
constantly wake up, like, terrified of the Elvis bust.
Oh my God. That's kind of messed up. That's such a liability. That's so spooky.
You know Elvis's ghost is in all of those busts.
Yeah, every single portrait of Elvis is haunted, I think we can say.
For sure.
Yeah. So you also, the haunting aspect of your album was not limited to its inspiration in this painting. You also mixed the album at a haunted studio.
Yeah.
Where was this and why is it haunted and how?
Yeah, Emily and I were doing a little text prep prior to this taping. I was like, I feel like I've tread over all my haunted stories on other podcasts on this album, which is great. I'm happy that I'm finally getting to talk about ghosts on an album cycle. Yeah. But I have not talked about Sonic Ranch, which is where we mixed this album. It's in Tornillo, Texas, recently famous for ICE crimes against humanity. But it is the largest residential recording studio in the world. And it is on a pecan ranch that was in the guy who runs it, family for forever. So it's still active with pecans. He sends some out to like people who record at the studio every year for Christmas. They're very delicious. And apparently I didn't know this when we elected to mix there. I had just, toured it a couple times. I feel like there's some long stretch you do on every tour that is between like Arizona. I feel like you play Phoenix and then you play Austin and that's like a horrifying drive in between. And you,
I just did
still
it.
Need to drive. You did it. So you know exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw that you were like, you texted me at some point. You were like, I'm so jealous of your road trip. And I was like, you've probably done this so many more times than I have. Jesus.
So I've been able to tour that studio while passing between Phoenix and Austin. And I think I'd even stayed there before, or at least we've like had dinner there. And because it's residential, people are there for long stretches of time. They have like cooks on staff who make perhaps the best salsa I've ever had in my life. Really, really good breakfast tacos every day.
This I'm really like glad heaven.
It's kind of heaven until I tell you about the hellish aspects. Oh. I could not record vocals there ever because I would just have acid reflux from eating too much like really spicy salsa every day. So it's good that we mixed. So I've stayed there. It's like amazing. So much cool equipment. Tony, who owns the studio, is an art collector. So there's like Picasso and Degas prints in like every studio and even residence. So we got there on the first day and we're told the rooms you're supposed to stay in aren't ready. Like one of the bands that's also tracking is staying a little later, but you can move to the room you're supposed to be in the next night. So Sarah, who mixed the album, and I were like, okay, we'll stay in this like, it's like a newer built bedroom that's right off the kitchen. And we're like, it's not as like fancy as the old casita rooms, but like, fine, we'll stay here. We're fine with whatever. Only the next day do we find out that pretty much every other room has like some kind of horrifying haunting story, whether it's someone waking up and seeing a man sitting in the corner, just like watching them sleep. There are stories of a bed hovering. There are stories of like a little girl floating above you while you sleep. So, and then there's the one we were supposed to be in. There's like one of the engineers we were working with was like, that's my favorite room, but also there's like a presence that's there all the time. And Yeah, so we wound up not switching our rooms because we wanted to stay in like the newly built one that surely wasn't haunted. I'm totally into haunted things in like a situation I can control. I just don't want to wake up and see a guy floating above me.
Staring at you while you sleep.
Lose sleep worrying about it when you're supposed to be like working and being at top like mental state or whatever. Yeah.
We were working already really, really long hours. Like, I think we pulled a more than one all-nighter. Just didn't want to deal with a floating guy. But maybe if I go record there, it would be a nice, inspiring thing. And the other fun fact I told Emily about this studio, when I first went through and met the guy who owns it, I was like, it's so weird. Like, he really reminds me of David Carradine for some reason. And I said this, and then like maybe a year later found out that apparently Tarantino would like pass through this studio. Tony seems to know like everybody. He's just a El Paso legend. He's like buddies with ZZ Top, and Billy Gibbons comes to the studio all the time. So I had said this a year before and then found out that apparently Bill from Kill Bill is based on Tony.
What?
Which is amazing.
Or like in some part inspired by him.
I sent you guys the link to the picture of him, but it's like very apparent when you see his picture.
If you just Google him, you'll see all kinds of pictures.
Like, what was Tarantino doing there? Just hanging out and having the salsa and the pecans? Like,
I guess so. Tony seems to know everybody. He's like a really lovely person who has all kinds of incredible like stories that it's not always clear if they're completely true about like Juarez cartel activity. He told us a very fun story about hand soup being delivered to someone in El Paso once. So
hand?
He's an interesting
character.
Like soup
character. Made from a hand?
Soup made from human hands.
Wow.
Pardon?
I just watched Texas Chainsaw Massacre, so this completely tracks.
Right. No, like Molly has not flinched in listening. She's like, yeah, that's Texas.
Well,
apparently.
You know, they make hand soup down there. It's a true story. It's said at the beginning of the movie.
Are you sure? It's like hand soap, but hand soap.
Nope. Soup.
That's incredible. I see this all, even the ghost stuff, even the spooky stuff, even the presence of Quentin Tarantino. This all sounds kind of like right now, my latest quarantine era dream is to have like a home studio or have like a residential studio. Like I want to like buy a farmhouse in Iowa and let people come through and like finish movies in it. This is the first time I've spoken this publicly, but like I'm putting it out into the universe.
Now it's got to manifest.
Once again, I'm saying Texas Chainsaw Massacre, be very careful with those old farmhouses.
We don't have so many cannibals in Iowa, but we have Children of the Corn. So.
Right, exactly.
The fun reason why, not fun, but there's a couple of different, like, of course, once I heard that this is haunted, I'm going on all the weird, like, forums that look like they're from 1998 reporting every ghost sighting in Tornillo, Texas. There's apparently a little girl by the, little ghostly girl by the train tracks. There's a few outside of Sonic Ranch itself, but it's quite literally the border. Like, you could walk and be in Mexico quite easily. And apparently some of the buildings on site at this studio, which is like pretty large, there's like trucks and stuff on site that you have to drive to get around to some of the different studios. So they've made use of some really old buildings, and some of them were apparently used as like a holding cell for people crossing the border. So there's like probably some messed up stuff that happened prior to it becoming this farm, which maybe explains like...
Yeah, it's attracted some bad energy
and
there.
Sitting in the corner.
Yeah.
So there's apparently good and bad ghosts there, but I didn't get to meet any by choice. I was too scared.
Well, we wanted to take a night call with you. It's also a night email. Do any of you guys want to read it?
Yeah, this comes from London Eddie. Hi, Night Call crew. Longtime listener, first time emailer, big fan of the Pod Heavy podcast. I went to an isolation pod for my 21st birthday on a whim, decided to ignore any skeptical thoughts, and figuratively dived into the experience. During the hour-long float, I achieved more of a genuine meditational feeling than I had ever gotten from traditional methods. I spent the following 3 hours feeling the same floaty feeling across my entire body slash consciousness. The feeling only started to wane after I'd been in the cinema for a while, and the crazy third act of Sorry to Bother You came crashing down. Interestingly enough, the isolation center was in the middle of London's central business district. By the look of the other customers, it seemed like high-powered execs have swapped their weekly squash court lunches for hour-long isolation sessions. I wish I'd stayed to ask one if it helps to escape or if it helps them visualize.
I can't decide if it's like a real... I also misread this email the first time, and I thought that while he was in the chamber, while he was in his meditative state, like, he had a flashback to the third act of Sorry to Bother You.
I thought he was using using it as a metaphor, and I was like, I wonder what he means by this.
I think he went to the movies and he saw Sorry to Bother You, which seems like a crazy thing to do after being in an isolation pod. That's like a lot of movie.
But to be fair, I didn't know what was coming in the third act of Sorry to Bother You before I saw it. So maybe, you know, he thought it'd be light.
It brought everybody down.
Have you ever done an isolation pod or anything like that, Sadie?
Absolutely not. Even hearing at first I was like, what is isolation pod? I thought it was like an escape room. And then when you said float, I was like, oh, it's a float tank. Even it's hearing that tank. Expression, my heart rate.
Are you claustrophobic or is
no,
it just like...
I just have a hyperactive brain that would not be able to cope.
See, I wonder, because I feel like that too. And apparently though, when you have zero, like, I think maybe for the first few minutes, you're kind of like, your mind is racing. This is what I've heard. But then for some reason, the absolute lack of stimuli makes you calm down. I would like to experience that. I would also like to have a panic button on hand.
I think you do. There is a way to get
out. I'm sure
out,
right? You do.
Yeah. I feel like I'd be so like bored and then stressed about that, then angry that I'd put myself in the situation to be bored and stressed and angry. I don't know.
I would think it would be like meditation though. It's like you
go
through all
that.
Yeah.
Even if I'm like on a treadmill, I have to be like listening to something and also reading on the you know.
Yeah. I managed to actually meditate for probably like 3 minutes or something for the first time, I think, in my life when I was in Iowa recently. And I, you know, that was encouraging to me. I was like, oh, maybe I can do this more. But I was always fairly convinced and still am fairly convinced that it's just not a thing I do naturally. Too many synapses.
I'm sure it'd be good if I could get to that point, but not yet. Definitely not while floating.
What kind of, are there any kind of like holistic-y or new agey things like isolation tanks that you would ever consider exploring?
I mean, I do all kinds of hippie shit.
What's the best hippie shit?
I guess, you know, I get acupuncture, which in some ways is, you know.
That's just medicine. Well, a lot of that stuff is stuff that you just can't do now. I mean, the isolation pod is probably like one of the safe things you could do because it's literally an isolation pod. But, you know, when I was in Vegas, I was like walking through the like one of these like malls that connects the two casinos, and they had a bunch of those aqua massage tables out. You know, like the tube where the water pummels people. It's basically you get put into a rubber bag and then like jets of water like massage you so you don't get wet, obviously. But it's very disturbing to watch because it just looks like a body in a body bag getting washed with water.
Sounds like getting eaten by a waterbed. Like it just like wrapped in a waterbed. I've never
seen
that.
That's sort of the idea. But I was also like,
that sounds nice though.
I think it's probably feels really good. And I was also like, oh, this makes a lot of sense. I mean, aside from like being in a mall, but like, you know, massages are sort of hard to come by if that's something that you're getting regularly or like, you know, something that, you know, your muscles need or whatever, like you can get pummeled by some water instead of human hands. The machines will do all the work.
I'm not going to I guess I'm putting my mom on blast a little bit here. I'm going to tease my mom. Sorry, mom. She, before all this, she has a gym membership in Connecticut. And she'll go on the elliptical. She does 15 minutes on the elliptical, like a very casual pace. And then she goes, there's like a waterbed massage thing at the gym. And she'll go on that for like 45 minutes. So I'm pretty sure she only has the gym membership to use the like massage machines that they
have. That's legit. Especially in the before times, if you could get a gym with a steam room in it, like that's worth the membership. Like
Equinox shit.
I miss my gym. I miss my weird steam room at the Glendale YMCA.
I was going to say, I'm Hollywood Y over here.
The Glendale Y was actively haunted, and that was part of what I loved about it. It had an empty hot tub that had just lights flickering on it all the time.
Like a David Lynch hot tub.
Pools and hot tubs and steam rooms are just haunted.
Yeah, haunted hot tub is our vibe.
A lot of the YMCAs out here feel haunted because the Hollywood one is very haunted feeling. It's like a labyrinth, and it's all of these like very strange old buildings with
it's an old like Spanish style building, right?
Yeah. And it has like a lot of like courtyards with kind of, you know, all of these like multi-story buildings around it. So you see like the little faces in the window when you're standing in the courtyard. I thought it was haunted. My daughter did ballet, and it felt very, that room was especially like had a vibe. Had a cool breeze.
Yeah. You sound nice. I'm wishing I lived outside of Philly where our Y is not nearly as lovely.
Well, before we let you go, I wanted to talk a little bit because I realized it had been like a year since you were part of this No Music for ICE campaign, which was really awesome and is still active, apparently. But this was kind of happening around the Amazon Music Festival that happened like in last December, which I recently saw like a billboard for that was still up because, you know, like no billboards are getting turned over. So I actually saw like a billboard for the Amazon.
They have so much money. They probably just forgot to stop paying for it.
Yeah. They'll still be advertising this music festival from December. But yeah.
It apparently was a massive flop and had almost no attendance. They had to like give away a bunch of tickets.
Yeah, I heard that they were just like giving out tickets or like deeply discounting them. But yeah, and it was this thing where, I mean, I was kind of surprised that there wasn't more of a at large rejection of that. Like there were so many people who were like, oh, cool. Yeah, Amazon's in the music festival business now instead of just sort of like, I don't know. It just felt like such a off-tone thing to do, especially with how much their involvement with ICE had been in the news recently. It's like, really? You're going to go like do the Halliburton Music Festival? Like, it just, I don't know. That was, but I really appreciated your involvement and like, you know, how vocal you were around that.
It was a cool thing to be a part of, and it was amazing to see how many people pretty instantly signed on to it. I think we announced it and had about 1,000 musicians sign on, like we announced it on a Friday, and by Monday there were over 1,000 signatures of just a lot of musicians who pledged not to do collaborative projects with Amazon until they ended it's such a complicated net of like subsidiaries, but basically Amazon technology powers not only the infrastructure that ICE uses to track and deport people, but also a lot of police departments use for like facial recognition, stuff like that. Just a lot of like messed up surveillance
technology. All that Palantir stuff. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Yeah. As I said, web of company names. So we did that project, and it was kind of funny. Like, I was working on this record while we launched that, and it was a really small group of people who started it, like maybe six of us. So I was tracking Haunted Painting when we launched, and I was in the studio doing like strings and woodwind stuff for the first time in my life, working like long, you know, 12, 13 hour studio days, and then immediately getting on my email to like send out to press about what was going on, and then waking up the next morning like 4 hours before studio time to like continue to send press emails and respond to them. So it was a very like kind of intense project to take on in the middle of like a very intense recording project. Even like when the festival was happening, we were trying to coordinate. We were able to get a bunch of the No Music for ICE t-shirts on the ground to festival attendees and sort of explain to them like why this is a problem. And that was all going on while I was at Sonic Ranch. So I taped like a local news segment, actually, weirdly over Skype, like before the quarantine started. I hadn't done something like that before. I taped like a Vegas news segment while I was mixing, like, gotta go outside one second just to talk about why no one should be at this festival. And for the most part, media didn't cover it. They didn't touch it. We released a list of press names, and it was all like, I'm the cannabis reporter for a college in like Reno. So it was funny to see it basically flop. But a lot of the people who are involved with No Music for ICE have kind of moved over to this Union of Musicians and Allied Workers, which launched in March. And we're sort of involved in a number of different projects that are not only like trying to secure more ethical pay and treatment for music workers, but also making clear our stances on human rights abuses like this and why musicians shouldn't collaborate with companies who choose to engage in them. So it's been it's been a nice group to be part of, and I'm really psyched on a lot of the projects that we're working on.
That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, I don't really know the ins and outs of all this stuff and how people are getting paid. I mean, one thing I was hearing from musicians was just like, oh, well, Amazon's platform, like Amazon Music, not necessarily, I don't know about the streaming platform, but like,
it's one of the lower paid, it's one of the lower pays per like stream or sale of any of the online music retailers, but
oh, really?
They're all pretty abysmal, honestly.
Like for sales too?
Mm-hmm. They take one of the highest cuts.
Wow. I mean, that's not surprising, I guess, considering
their
morals.
For books and movies and, you know, they're a monopoly.
Yeah. It's one of these things where it's just like, that's actually like kind of my biggest guilt point. Not Amazon. I basically removed Amazon from my life, but like Spotify and all these other, all the other streaming platforms and stuff. It's just really...
I mean, I use it too, but I also recognize that they could absolutely afford to pay people a fair rate per stream and have chosen that too. And I'm glad that a lot of people are starting to talk about that. And I'm glad that there's a whole streaming subcommittee in the union that I'm not part of. I work with the venues corner, which is about basically trying to make venues more safe for patrons, workers, musicians, et cetera. And a couple other points. But the streaming people have been really, really working on a campaign to basically request higher rates for the musicians that are part of the platform. The other thing that the streaming services don't do is like credits. So all kinds of things they could do to improve how people get paid from every part of the record. And they have not done that.
And it seems so crucial now too, because it's just like, oh, you cut out touring.
The only way we're
like,
making any money.
Yeah.
Have you done any like live stream shows or Zoom shows?
I've mostly been avoiding it because I don't, even before this, I hate to play solo. It's just like not fun for me. Uh-huh. And there's now the component where you have to like film and record yourself. So I not only have to like produce a video, but I have to like engineer and mix a song of something I don't even like doing. So I've mostly been saying no, but I did just do a big project that it took me like a week to get done, where I did a full band set. It was hell, but it's done. And maybe now that I know how to do it, I'll subject myself to it again.
It just seems like such a, like, aside from the work of on the musician side of like making your performance or whatever, is it's just like, isn't the whole point of live stuff that you're getting, you know, there's an exchange of energy between.
It's very dry and weird. But I mean, this was fun because I got to at least play with my bandmates, just like, you know. Removed in time and space.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, thank you so much for coming by the show this
week. Yeah, it was really fun.
I'm so glad we finally had you on. And everybody check out Haunted Painting. It's really great. Like, it's just genuine. Like, there's so many earworms in this album. It's just fantastic.
Thank you. I wish we'd got to do a video on it, but
I know. Maybe next time. Next one. Yeah, you got like, we didn't even get into it, but you've been like one of the most innovative music video making people right now too. It's like you really got over that COVID production obstacle.
They
was great.
They all took so much longer than any music video I've done, just to be safely
Yeah. But no, it's like such a, it paid off because you're just like, how did you do that? It's so great.
And we put a song from your album on the October Night Call mix.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Spooky Halloween times.
So Sadie, where can people find you online?
Well, I have the best URL you can imagine. It's sad13, which is spelled SAD13, dot horse.
What?
It's dot horse.
Stop.
Yeah.
I didn't even know that there was dot horse
dot
before
horse.
I saw
I didn't
this.
Either, but as soon as I knew, I was like, I can't be sad13.com anymore. And it forwards now to sad13.horse. That's and beyond incredible. That, I'm extremely overactive on all the social media platforms, also at sad13.
You're great. You're great on Twitter. Great follow.
You are.
Thank you. Thank you. As are you.
Well, thanks so much for being on the show.
Yeah, it was really fun.
And thank you for listening to Night Call. You can find us on social media. We're on Twitter at Night Call Pod and Instagram at Facebook at Night Call Podcast. You should leave us a review on iTunes if you are listening on iTunes, or even if you're not listening on iTunes. We love a review. Give us a nice review. It helps more people find our show. And of course, subscribe if you aren't already, wherever you get your podcasts. You can also join us on our Patreon. We're on Patreon at www.patreon.com/nightcall, where you can get our newsletter, our mixtapes, our bonus episodes. We got all sorts of fun stuff there for you. And we shall see you all next week. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.